What, right?
Yep, you just hit record.
And now it's 23 and it's new track and it's recording?
Hit stop when you're ready to stop.
Wow.
It's fairly straightforward.
It is fairly straightforward.
Into
it. I can get
it's funny
into
that processing has the like audio interface.
You gotta pull that up for me.
Wait. Oh,
yeah.
Also
yeah.
Video, but I meant
sure.
Like a
recorder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did we get, you did?
Yeah, I'm able to back the. It's proven itself pretty well, I guess.
I mean, it's proven itself kind of like really well. Like, I guess it's kind of like.
I just mean in terms of getting people to try.
Oh, right, I know, but like, it's not actually. It's not like it's more straightforward than programming in another language.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of confusion about process flow. Like, what is it like to program?
I mean, I guess the nice thing about both the Arduino interface and the processing interface is that, like, I remember when I first, like, heard about programming, I would see people programming, and I would be like, that is not a text editor. I cannot program with a text editor. What is going on?
Right.
Okay, you guys want to get close and pretend you like each other? How
get close.
Scratch?
Pretend.
It's hard when you're jumping around.
I want some tea.
Here.
I took your beer and I threw it to the curbside.
Apparently. And now it's just going to
I'm really close to the mic. I guess we're going to have to hear my questions.
Oh. Are those questions?
You're cheating. you're reading ahead. You're skipping to the end of the story.
How many people cheated? Can you slide closer?
Not many.
There you go.
I see. I thought it was only audio.
Me too.
Oh no, not closer to the mic, just closer to the frame.
Okay, this is a story all about how my life got turned upside down. Let me take a moment, just sit right there. I'll tell you how I'm interviewing Alec and Sharon Lynn.
I was excited for how you would rhyme that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I would. I would did a really good job earlier today. Do we need white balance?
I wish we had that on tape.
It was pretty sweet.
Something that Sean Lynn does. Do you morph people's names at all, or do you stick with Alec, like their full name?
Oh,
it's like you could do. Sean Lynn does a dog sometimes, for example.
A dog. Cool. We should. Okay. So first, I guess mission statement does hip hop. I told you I was gonna do it.
It's true, and I didn't do the homework.
Mission what?
Bilal told me that he's asked everyone to do their mission statement in hip hop or iambic pentameter. And that nobody's been able to rise to the occasion.
We
even
also
with
haiku.
What was that awesome haiku that we heard?
Haikus are easy, but sometimes they don't make a lot of sense. Refrigerator.
Classic.
Okay. Well then.
Nagel had something, but he's not here.
Nagel had something? Oh, crap. Okay.
But you didn't even tell me.
Oh, that's true. I didn't take it seriously.
Oh.
Please, everyone.
Yeah, phones on silent, and girls on film.
Girls on film! Girls on film!
Can you hand these to
all? Oh, shoot, yeah, you guys have to...
Okay,
you have
to be
take
more stylish.
Seriously. So, I guess what we're going to start off with is, because this isn't exactly a hackerspace, let's do it like this. Who are you, and where are we? And you have to repeat the question, and remember, anytime you're like, oh, I just bit my tongue instead of spoke words, unbite, and repeat yourselves, and say, quish, quish. Let's do that again. Hi, my name is Alec, and I'm Sean Lynn. You're a sprout. Sprout is a...
You want to go first?
Hi, my name's Sean Lynn. This is Alec, looking at you.
You look at me, and you can start over.
I'm Sean Lynn, this is Alec, and you're at Sprouts.
Cool. Alec, do you speak?
Yes, occasionally.
Okay, so this isn't a hackerspace. Let's ask you a question that might seem a bit odd, but why do you think I'm interested in talking to you doing a documentary about hackerspaces?
I think you see threads behind hackerspaces that overlap or tangentially related to what we're doing, and in particular, I think when you're talking about creative spaces, there's no need necessarily to be bound by we're a hackerspace, or how people socially identify, because there's not so much of a difference between the motivations that people have, even if there's a big difference between how they're going about what they're doing.
Cool.
As in a lot of ways, hackerspace kind of tells you about the tone of a community, and I think you can just go.
Yeah. So I guess this is going to be a tough question to start off with, but what best describes what's going on here?
Nothing yet. And by that I mean we're working towards our mission, which we haven't talked about yet, but so far, we've only had a couple classes and programs running here, and we've spent most of our effort setting up the space after spending several months on refining kind of our vision for the organization.
Cool. So while answering the first question, you mentioned that when you're talking about creative spaces, there is no real need to define them. And I would definitely, or not define them,
yeah.
Or to like put boundaries between them and call them different.
I mean spaces. Specifically in the context that we've talked about, in terms of what purposes creative spaces serve for people.
But my question was leading towards why do you believe that a lot of these creative spaces that are popping up that are surrounding the act of basically learning through making and education and call themselves hacker spaces? Why do you think that this word and this concept is bubbling forth right now?
I don't think it's necessarily just bubbling up as hacker spaces. I think there are a lot of collective art spaces that are popping up. I think like the history of having public but independent art galleries, independent publishing companies and things like that has a really long history. And I think hackerspace in some ways is kind of a modern incarnation that is in some ways being paralleled in other domains.
There are all sorts of co-working spaces. Like, so co-working has also taken off in the past decade or so, right? And I think in particular hackerspaces benefit a lot from the social capital and the identity and the language that, in particular, online culture has given it, right? So over the past however many decades, you've seen an ascendancy of the social capital of being a geek or a nerd or whatever. And at some point that crystallized online, right? And in particular, publications like Make Magazine and the blog network that rises up around it gives people lots of language and I think a pretty coherent way to describe themselves as part of a community. And the fact that you see lots of instantiations of people's excitement to see that online community mirrored in the real world, I don't think is necessarily too surprising, given how straightforward I think a lot of the pieces involved in bringing people together around some physical resources can end up being.
Okay, cool. Well, before we start trying to make parallels and mirroring between what's happening at Sprout and what's happening in these spaces, I'd like to, first of all, ask, what is the core value and mission statement of Sprout? And we'll talk about the concrete steps in the next question. But yeah, what is the mission statement of Sprout?
I think, very broadly, we want to, the language we throw around is make science a cultural activity. So,
they've heard this before.
From him?
One of his questions is, so do you think science is becoming a cultural activity?
Why, yes, I hope it will.
And I just kind of wanted to see people's reactions to that question. Kind of like, what do you guys think of World War II?
Right.
Complicated.
Is that your face?
I'm forced.
With World War II, it's complicated. Okay.
So
yeah.
What have people said when you asked that?
You can have to, you know what, you can watch. I can give you every single clip from every time I ask that question.
Okay.
I think it'll be cool.
Yeah.
We should just make a documentary where we just ask people what they think about World War II.
That would be a fun documentary to do next.
Just go up to people on the street and be like, so
what
do
you
about
think?
World War II?
Some people say it's going to be great.
Okay, well, let us do this because footage runs low, batteries are
right.
Low. Did we've talked about mission statement? We were beginning to, but I think we got clipped.
Yeah.
So, Sprout mission statement. Hip-hop would be good. Anything would be great.
I think, yeah, look, I, but I don't say like I said, because they're not going to know. So, so very broadly, we want to work to see what it could look like if science were a cultural activity. In particular, I think we've been using how people relate to music as a model for that. So you can kind of do anything for your day job, come home and be in a band, or write online music reviews, or be in a band full-time and be touring. And it's totally valid to call yourself a musician, no matter what level of musicianship or commitment you espouse. And I think in science, this is not the case. Once you pull out the word scientist, people want you to pull out your diploma and prove to them that you kind of have the credential to kind of say anything or even be legitimately interested. And we're really excited to explore what the equivalent of album critics or jam sessions are in the context of science. And I don't think it'll be a direct mirror, but it's exciting to see where that'll go.
Because in part, right, when people relate to music, everyone is okay having an opinion about a song that they hear. And so I think people are much more comfortable taking for granted the reliability or credibility of their judgment. Whereas in science, you kind of like hand over an article and say, so what do you think about that? Not only do most people not care, most people say, like, I'm not a science person, or I'm not a math person, or there are all sorts of ways that people feel disempowered to engage with that. And that ends up meaning that there's this kind of vacuum for how do you trust people, and does it mean to be a scientist? And like, I've never experienced any facet of that, or I really hated my science class, and so on. And so I think we want to look at what it means to work within a community to open up the resources necessary to provide for a larger variety of ways that people can relate to science.
Yeah, and even thinking about the musicians who are very highly regarded, like someone like Bob Dylan, even his fans say, like, he has a terrible voice. But that doesn't mean that they don't respect or value something else in his music. And I think in science, most people don't have a sense that there is that something else other than kind of like the very technical and kind of rigid process that it goes through now.
Cool. I guess there's a whole range of questions that we can go through from there, but I see science as just an inquisitive mind trying to discover what are at the moment the best truths you can discover with the tools you have available. I think if you took a microscope to Bob Dylan's music, you would find the flaw. But there is no flaw really in science. How could you have science be
true.
Something that you can mush?
Wait, I think there's the trivial counterexample, the fact that science changes, right? The fact that scientists practice always being skeptical means that they end up being wrong. But much more significantly than that, I think it's pretty hard to have unbiased facts. And by that I mean the effect of a fact ends up being totally dependent on its context, right? So global warming is an easy example, right? Where the facts around it only tell a very small part of the story. And in particular, the fact that people don't feel empowered to engage with any of that scientific data means that you have all these other institutions around whose responsibility it is that maybe they don't even take seriously or acknowledge to help people to relate to that in some meaningful way. But I think the act of doing science, whatever that means, I think, like you said, is much more about being inquisitive and creative in certain ways than anything else. And just as like a story that you make can be false in certain ways, science that you do can be bad in certain ways or false in certain ways. And I think that we want people to think of science not just as a way you can find things out about the world, but as an act of self-expression. Because within like the community of scientists, I think lots of people identify with a lot of the same aesthetics that artists do, right? It's a very like heroic or noble or often solo endeavor where you're after this big ideal of truth or beauty or whatever it is. And those dimensions are completely cut off from people when you describe science as a big bag of facts that people have, you know, verified to the 10th decimal place or whatever.
So I like talking to people that have actually considered the language, and I know you guys think that language is very important. What is some of the language that you're trying to develop with Sprout or that you're using with Sprout?
I think one of the things that kind of jumping off of what we were just talking about is the idea of scientific investigation being not about unearthing knowledge or facts, but about developing understanding. So thinking about what you're trying to do as creating more accurate models and kind of exploring rather than thinking of your process as aiming very directly at a specific thing that at which point you'll be done or at which point you will have succeeded.
Yeah, because I think part of it is that all of us came to work on Sprout, and in particular the context of science as a cultural activity, from some dissatisfaction with education. And I think one of the things that we see as a big problem is how little the reflective components of education or learning are emphasized. And I think one thing that science has to offer that's really compelling is language about models and the idea that even beyond just a more accurate model, a more generative model, right? Because you can imagine in some crazy world where you grow up learning only quantum mechanics, the flight of a baseball is very, very complicated in comparison to if you like learn about it in the context of Newtonian physics, right? And so that's part of what I mean by like facts have their story, right? So in that case, it's a very narrow difference. We're switching the lens that you're looking at, even though both are, you know, accurate in the definition of science because it has all of its own qualifications. There's lots of flexibility in terms of how you think about describing your world. And I think that the fact that people lack the language around models, or the fact that people aren't comfortable thinking about models as just one way of telling a story, right? That you have many different ways of approaching the same thing, and that each facet has something pretty significant to contribute to your understanding, are really generative jumping off points for talking to people about the learning process and how you can be more reflective about it and things like that. And I think we've also been playing with the language of cultural activity, obviously, which is very dense and I think resonates with some people, but isn't very communicative until you go through the rigmarole of talking about music and how we wish it could be like that. And I think there are lots of dead ends right now in terms of our language, where we have to have a very big or long conversation with somebody to kind of fully communicate what we're hoping for and why we think it's important.
So I guess that is part of the concern. Part of it is your goals are broad and sweeping and involve a language that is dense,
mm-hmm.
and that does take explanation. So it's really important to have concrete steps.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the concrete steps that Sprout is taking to accomplish what you guys are doing?
Well, we've started working on our first project with a community partner, namely Green City Growers. So they install raised bed gardens in people's backyards. And we're working with them to develop a suite of sensors and software and a kind of educational program around it to instrument a garden. And their angle is that they're interested in increasing the yield of their gardens, and they've seen kind of surprising variations between raised bed gardens, even on the same block. And our angle, I think, is trying to look at how you can turn that garden into as generative or creative or inviting a laboratory or lens into different ways of looking at the world around you as possible. And so whatever the trade-off between their goals, our goals, and our budget is, will be what we end up doing. And the way that fits in the broader sense is that, as you pointed out, I think because our goals involve such dense language and such big ideas, largely we've decided that talking to people about it's irrelevant, and not the least of which because we only have ideas about what we want it to look like, and I think we're much more interested in trying to build a community of independent learners around us who are working on real world problems and questions, which really just means contextualized or authentic problems or questions that they're genuinely excited by, to try to illustrate not like what a better teacher could look like, but instead what it could look like if your world was more kind of inviting for your own education. And so I think we aren't interested necessarily in running better after school programs or running better classes, even if that's something that we end up doing. I think we're much more interested in trying to sketch out with what we're working on a very compelling or inspiring picture of what it means to think more carefully about what you do with the resources in your community and how it affects, like how their openness, for example, affects how easy it is for somebody to be generative or autonomous in their own learning and doing. So we're trying to explore that on a micro scale with our community projects, which the first of which we just started, and we'll be spinning up educational programs both here and in the community in the next month or so.
Cool. How do you, or what does it mean to build a community of, I forget the words you use, self-motivated?
Independent. Yeah, that's a confusing phrase too. I don't know if you want to talk about it.
And also, I'm not being mic'd. I mean, this thing is not very directional.
Oh, so you asked us
you.
To...
So, like,
oh,
so,
that's
what?
Why you said
repeat the questions. What does independent
quick.
Group of learners
quick
mean?
Learners, you guys.
So I think... what does group of independent learners mean?
No, I asked, how do you build a community of independent learners? I mean, like,
oh,
you can kind of understand, like, oh, independent learners, someone that learns independently.
Well, that's part of the thing. We don't necessarily want people to be independent of each other. What we're really trying to say is we want people to be autonomous in their learning and investigation. And that doesn't mean alone or solo or even entirely self-determining. I think it just means that... moving towards taking for granted that learning doesn't happen at the behest or pleasure of somebody else, that you don't need to go to an educator to learn, even if you choose to work with an educator to learn, right? Even if you choose to work with an expert to learn. So that's
mm-hmm.
what we're trying to get at when we start to say independent group of learners.
I think one of the concrete ways that that's come up as we've been thinking about whether, how many, and of like what nature we want classes that we're organizing to look like, kind of starting to question what does a class that doesn't dictate its students' activities but sort of helps them to become more independent or autonomous in defining their own investigations look like. So in particular saying, you know, intro to soldering is great if you've already defined your own context and said, I need to learn to solder and I do not know how, and you go and you kind of like have this consenting relationship with the teacher where you say, this is what I want to learn. But we've been trying to think about, you know, how do you make a structure such that the learning contexts offered aren't just based on what a teacher decides that they want to be teaching, and also how do you structure within a class such that people can bring their own like very personal context to it. So you can imagine like a class in installation art that doesn't say a class on installation art where you work with wood, where you install in Central Square, and we'll all brainstorm one project and go do it. But instead, the goal of the class is to have connections and kind of fingers out into the community to bring in people who have the skills to help facilitate the projects that people in the class are interested in. Or a programming class where it's expected that you come in feeling generative about specific projects, and then rather than having like an introduction to Python, you have an exploration of a like specific project that you're excited about.
So,
I was just going to say one way we talk about it is instead of trying to decide like what people should learn or could learn, trying to decide, figure out how to open up what we think would be best to put people into contact with so that they are generative in the way that they're learning, or they're generative in the way that they're determining what they want to be exploring. And that can mean anything from trying to couch the programs we run as, hey, I want to teach this thing, does anybody want to learn? Or, hey, I want to learn this thing, does anyone want to learn with me? Or, hey, I need this resource, does anybody know where I can get access to it? So trying to bring people together and like close the loops kind of in what resources are available for people's investigations.
Cool. And also, if there's ever a point where you go through something that feels long-winded and you're going around and then you find your goal of what you're talking about, like,
yeah,
oh,
go.
That's what I was trying to say. Just go. And yeah, so...
Is that a subtle hint at all?
Yeah, you you definitely have a way of saying things in a rich way, but in a way that I think could be shortened up. Yes.
I could believe that.
Okay.
It's not something that's like just happening here. Like we find that a lot of people they talk their way through what they want to say.
Yeah, of course.
And by the end they know what they want to say.
I'm happy to be more straightforward. What would you like us to be shorter about?
Well, I will. I'll just let you know as we go forward. But
okay.
The next question is, I guess, do you think that what I was understanding was you create an environment in which discovery is intuitive?
Yeah, I think if you think of environment very broadly, we don't want the environment to be only within the walls of this building. We want the environment to be as kind of contiguous with the community as possible.
So why is there this building with green, blue, white walls that are filled with tools? What does this provide?
Because we're looking to be generative, in particular with the programs that we're running, and having a certain amount of ingredients around for the projects that you're working on and the investigations. When you say, let's say for our second community project, we were wondering, hey, can we do X, Y, Z? And you want to be able to prototype that. I think the friction or the kind of the startup cost of having to say, okay, we're going to completely spec out the first version, order everything from online, and then build it, and slows that down significantly. And beyond that, I think we're also very interested in figuring out what we can do to build community around us using the space as a lever, but not necessarily as the focal point. So whether that means holding events here that could also be held in your house or your garage, driveway, or wherever, I think that the tools that are here end up being incidental to what we want to be doing. And we want to open that up because we hope that we can demonstrate how compelling it'll be for people to open up the resources that they use every day, as opposed to replicate them from place to place to place to place.
So I think, I guess, the word that I started using sometime in this trip is using the world as a classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you would like to do is encourage the attitude of viewing the world as a classroom and using every resource available within this environment,
mm-hmm,
to educate yourself.
Yeah, and I think, in particular, thinking about a lot of the ways that tools get used educationally now are in a way that is removed from their actual use in the world. So in a university, you'll have a science lab set up. And then in a biotech company next door, you'll have a science lab set up. And then in the public high school next to that, you'll have a science lab set up. And there's kind of all of this redundancy when there's the science lab in the office building is not getting used from 5 p.m. to 9 a.m. And same thing with the public school. And I think a lot of what we're excited about is thinking of our space as our space, which we're excited to open up, because we have kind of this vision of other businesses and other maybe universities, other restaurants, opening up the physical resources that they have such that you don't need a classroom, so that you don't need a classroom to be learning. You kind of take for granted that whatever tools and resources and people and skills are around, that you can find a way to access them.
And I'd actually like to go back to the question about making the world your classroom, because I think that's something we're not trying to communicate that. In some ways, we're trying to communicate the exact opposite. And by that, I mean, we're trying to communicate that you aren't in need of a classroom when you have the world. And in particular, I think there are lots of schools and programs that try to bring as much of the real world into the classroom or bring as much of the classroom out into the world as possible. But in all of them, there's kind of the embedded assumption that whoever is doing the learning is doing the learning at the pleasure of and is in need of whoever is doing the teaching. And the scary part about that is that we don't want all the experiences available to you in the world to fall under the purview of education. What we'd actually like is for the learning to be incidental to the living, right? So a 5-year-old is not asking themselves, so how can I learn best today, right? They're asking themselves what they want to be doing today. And the stuff that they're most ready to learn happens to be maybe easy enough to facilitate or accommodate that they can live a life where their learning and their living are indistinguishable. And I think part of what we want to do is figure out how you can make that true for big kids too, and in particular, try to sidestep or work totally around people's idea that you need a classroom or educational facility or educator or anything like that to do your learning, because they do all sorts of other things in their lives where they're actively learning and they're just not thinking about it.
So I guess this brings us to like why you set up an organization, and why are you attempting to go for nonprofit status?
Yeah, we applied and we have fiscal agency through an organization. Mike Nagel couldn't join us, but started.
Yeah, so I feel like that enables you to reach out these tendrils and kind of say, hello, educational facility, we
mm-hmm.
would like this classroom. Hello, restaurant, we'd like to teach a class on sautéing onions because they're really delicious.
Mm-hmm.
let us use your kitchen this time. It'll be really
sure.
cool. We'll trade services. And this is possible because there's an organization.
Right.
But I think you would like to envision a world where this happens naturally.
Yeah.
Where people are like, yeah, let's just go to the restaurant. Let's
right.
saute some onions.
Right. You take for granted you can walk into a library, right? And that's something that's explicitly engineered for the public's benefit. But I think we want to figure out everything from the boring, like legal and pragmatic considerations of how do you make it as low stress as possible for a restaurant to open up their kitchen, right? Because they have all these questions about liability and cost and things like that. And all the way up to how do you build a community of people who are kind of poised to take advantage of the resources that can be opened up in a community. And I think this organization is our stepping stone to demonstrating the power for that.
And I think we also have the hope that at first it'll clearly be Sprout vouching for people.
Right.
And it will be like our organization kind of facilitating directly this type of relationship or these types of relationships. But my hope at least is that eventually it turns into like a very human level type of vouching system where, you know, maybe, you know, I have a friend who isn't comfortable letting anyone come into their house, but I can say, oh, you know, I've worked with this person. We taught a class together. We play basketball together, whatever. And people's resource networks just begin to be enlarged by, in some ways, trust, but a lot of ways also just like legal and social lubrication, I guess.
So, okay, yeah, I see. now, I would like to bring in the relationship between hackerspaces and what you have just described. A hackerspace, I believe, might have that same goal of being able to use all these resources that are diverse and encourage people to self-educate through them. But instead of being like, we'll use their kitchen and we will use their machine shop,
mm-hmm.
they're like, well,
we should have a
kitchen. We should have a machine shop. We should have our biology equipment. And we are a community of self... one second. We are a community of independent learners utilizing the society that we've built
mm-hmm.
around these people that also desire this sort of education, and
mm-hmm.
we have this sort of resource. And then if we need some more, we have the organization of the superstructure of hackerspaces in general,
right.
where there's this a concept of trust,
mm-hmm.
where I can go to any of these hackerspaces and like, oh, they have a DNA sequencer. Let's say once upon a time, galaxy far, far away, this happens. And the thing is, I think that is perhaps it's a really good goal on both parts. I don't follow completely to the end goal that you would, basically you guys are requiring a revolution.
I don't think that's true.
You don't think so?
I mean, I think that's what we want to work towards, but I don't think that's true that if I wanted to take you to the Edgerton Center at MIT, I could do that next week. I could talk to somebody at MIT and say like, hey, right, it is me. And I think that what we want to do is figure out how can you make an organization that has enough social capital and both has enough community trust and enough community connections such that you don't need to have like a, well, I was going to say name brand diploma. I don't have like... I think we want to figure out how you can build an organization that has the social capital and community connections to be able to open up those resources to people. And I think that we're a stone's throw away from opening up plenty of those resources. So an easy example, that's a great example locally, is Red Bones. So Red Bones is an awesome restaurant whose owner is kind of notoriously community-minded. And what that means is that he's always willing to host people's events and always willing to lend his support in whatever way he can. And that's something that has like a long history of small businesses doing things for their community. And universities have a long history of running, you know, high school enrichment programs and after school programs and having their students volunteer in their surrounding community. And so I think the impulse is already there. But I think what's missing is, like Shalyn said, a variety of kind of social and some of them technical tools, which might be as simple as here's a waiver that the university's lawyers and a nonprofit can understand and agree to lubricate opening up those resources. And I do think that what we're asking for in the long run, where you take that for granted, is asking for a revolution, but that's what we're trying to work towards.
So I guess a medium-term goal, do you believe that you could develop, like sprouts in a package normally grow in a bunch. Garbanzo beans are friends with each other.
Right.
Do you think that the first step would be in encouraging more people to start organizations that open up these resources to their local communities?
I think we'd want to do that implicitly or even explicitly in what we say. But I think right now we're trying to be as focused as we can on turning our work into something that's a model or inspiring or something that you can have a discussion around. And in particular, I think we conceive of our midterm goals as trying to kind of set the agenda or set the terms of the discussion around what it looks like for communities to be rich environments for people to learn in. And I don't think we're looking to spread that influence through some sort of like viral replication where lots of people are doing what we're doing.
I think in particular, it's not totally clear what exactly success would look like. So at this point, we don't have a manual or like a to-do list that we can give to someone and say, and this is what your community will look like when you have achieved this and the steps that you'll take. But as we start to, we hosted a spaghetti dinner a while ago and we had around like 40 people show up, and the restaurant that Alec was talking about actually offered us their pots because we didn't know if we would have pots big enough to be cooking in. And I think kind of having like small relationships like that develop with people who aren't notoriously known for being community-minded, where you sort of figure out how it can be easy for them to get involved with the people and organizations around them, is where we want to focus, just because there aren't a lot of compelling models for what that should look like yet.
Because ideally, like with hackerspaces.
Let's take a break. We have one more minute left on this tape, but I'd rather switch tapes so we don't cut you off in the middle of like, what I think hackerspaces. Okay. So what do you guys feel about the direction of the interview so far? I'm trying to just like see what you guys are talking about and develop in my mind what I think you guys are doing.
Yeah.
And then make connections between it and something else. I might try to prod a little bit.
Yeah, prod harder.
And I really did want to have fun with you guys. Like, there's a whole bunch of fun questions that I want to ask, but...
can't believe you didn't tell me about the iambic pentameter.
It's true. Yeah,
that's a we didn't quite yet.
That's true.
Here,
take some time.
Take some time. We would like the battery charge for a little bit.
Do you want some more tea?
I would like some more tea and iambic pentameter hip hop interpretive dance. I dare you. Dare you to do interpretive dance?
Would any of you guys like tea or I guess you would beer?
Thank you.
if nothing else, we're spreading the term hacker space.
Look at that.
You know how many bridge ports we've seen?
They're so awesome.
You know, we've been.
This is amazing.
It's which is amazing because Bridgeport went out of business in the 60s.
It's so good.
But why?
It's the mill.
Everybody copies the design. Like, there are other qualities.
How did you go out of business?
I don't know. It's because the machine lost forever.
Oh!
I'm not even kidding.
So
they went out of business in the best
because they're too good.
You know what?
It's like that gun.
I wish that if that happened, the government would buy all the cars.
Well, it's hard to improve on that.
Well, that's my point. That the government should then own that and move it to it. Hey, anybody who wants to now can build bridge ports and sell them.
Well, not everyone copied them. Like, this design, this vertical knee, like, kind of layout. Like, you know, the X and the Y, it's all.
It feels so.
Solid.
Well, that's the other thing.
It's a real machine. It's covered in green.
It's awesome.
But that's the other thing. That, like, the heavier it is, the less, drift.
Yeah.
I gotta wipe my hair.
Yes, handles.
Yeah, we just got a shotsmith.
This is my favorite one.
I have my hammer space. Oh, that's beautiful.
Oh, it's not connected. Multi machines.
Lathe, mill press, horizontal drill, disc sander, table saw.
Mill.
Mill. I don't know if it's mill. We have a small mill, like a tabletop. Manual mill that we can convert to CNC, which I'm probably going to do when I get back. Tabletop lady.
Say you have a really heavy thing here, you need a mill on the side. You can do that. But like this thing here looks like a bolt, but it's not actually a gear drive. So you can
twist it.
Like if you want
to. So you can then go down that.
If it comes up from here, you can see like there's a gear teeth there.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, it might be locked. Force it. So then you also have other stuff here. You see there's a teeth here, this thing can slide in and out, which is this guy here. This is so much you can do with it. But the key is once you make adjustments, you need to then true it to the cables here like that, because it's perfectly flat. Like that, this is aligned perfectly good, which is tricky. All that quilting. So when you engage this, this thing will automatically feed the thing. But then you have to stop it before you hit that, because if it's automatically feeding, when it hits that, and the stop, then you will break. Like, you'll break the quill.
Oh, probably.
Yeah. Which is not good.
Well, sometimes you need to know where it's at.
Doesn't that is it
automatically disengage us? I can't see opening it up like that. I think it might automatically raise.
Yeah, I've been wanting to take our alarm machine class. It's kind of aggravating trying to make the project without knowing exactly what you would use all this stuff for. Like, we have so much stuff in our space between, like, the ridge point, the lathe. I don't really even know what lathe is for.
Well,
I
don't even, like,
you
turn right.
So you can make some
shape. Well, really interesting, like, the key thing with a mill is that you turn the tool. The key thing with a lathe is that you turn it first. In the tool stationary. So, a lathe will make cylinders about a certain axis. Like, you can have it offset.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so this is a 3-jaw chuck, so it's going to align to the center. This is also a 3-jaw chuck. Look, check this out. It's a 4-jaw chuck.
Wow.
You can do this all in front of each other. You have a curve and then something else that isn't cut.
So you could have like a part that is a metal edge.
And there's also something called dog plates where you can have it all crazy off center, like have your part all crazy off center, so that you can then drill a hole perfectly. You can also drill offset holes this way. Like that's you can do turning operations or facing operations with this guy. Or even do drilling operations. I don't even have a set of like this, but you have this is called a live center because it's this. Normally you just have this in there and then drill on there. And then you would need a bore hole. Very accurately. What you can do is thread. So you, or like there's auto cranking, actually don't have some threads. No, this can't do threads.
So if you have like a big block of metal, you can stick it into this thing, and you can make
stick it in this thing, pretty much. But you can do other things.
And then you can bore those middle out.
You can bore your middle. You don't have to necessarily do something, you can do other shapes. Like a curve. Well, no, they can't really do a curve, cylinder. Chase threads. This has to be able to chase threads because it's got this.
What do you mean chase threads?
So you, like, how do you thread something without a dire attack? Okay, so you know how this is a thread.
Right.
Like a screw, like the all
threads.
Those are threads on them. You can thread things like the verb. You can make threads on them. So a tap is something where you twist into it and it cuts little bits of metal out. Like you drill a specific size hole and then you twist a tap into it. It makes it into a nut, basically. Like so then you can put a screw and then a die makes something into a screw. So on a lathe, you can make the screw or the nut. But you can make screws. You set it to the correct speed, which is really slow. And then you engage with the auto feed. And then this will automatically and then cut. And then you back off, and you go back to the game, you advance a little bit, and you cut your thread a little deeper. You do that a couple times, it's called chasing threads. And if you always engage the auto feed, except that you engage right on this line, mark line up the one. If you always engage from that line up the one, you never pop through it. And then something would be a helical thing. But it's cool though.
What's going on in these spaces? And why?
I just haven't thought of making those things.
Like you see this? Like how the
one
shape?
You can do that all the
but beautiful turn sort of shape. This actually looks like it was cast. It's all one piece, so you can do that. I mean, you can't really do that in the middle, but that would be very difficult on the ecosystem. So you can cast it, or you make the shot. Or you can
work.
Yeah, I can turn it as possible.
I thought it was going to be a short flip change.
And you have a college. There's a lot of them.